Heavenly Father, we lift up this entire morning to you, and we put it in your hands. We want to hear from you. We want to have our hearts opened to hear from the Holy Spirit. We pray something about this talk, something about these talking points and wisdom gathered here. We pray that it would have just a rippling effect on our church that would set people free and just bring more spirituality into our church. In Jesus' name. Well, last week we looked at all of the difficulties with pornography. We saw we're in a dire situation. For one, we're facing a multi-billion dollar industry, $97 billion annually. We saw that it is just incredibly pervasive throughout our culture. Men, 18 to 30, about two-thirds of them are looking at porn several times per week. Women, about 20%. Not as much, but still quite a bit. Highly addictive and damaging, just by way of summary. This week, we want to look at our resources. For one, the Holy Spirit. You know, I'm sure the Holy Spirit is where weeping about this topic and really convicted and feeling like it's hopeless. I'm sure the Holy Spirit is saying, I've dealt with worse. Okay. I dealt with infanticide in the Roman era. I dealt with Corinthian ritual prostitution. I can deal with pornography. Don't worry about that. We have God's promises to us. Jesus promised us in Matthew 16 and 18, just totally calmly, didn't feel the need to back this up in any sort of way. Jesus says, I will build my church. The gates of Hades will not withstand the church. Just completely confident assertion. And it's a promise. We also have the promise from 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, which teaches that this is the will of God for you. Namely, your sanctification. So we might feel fatalistic. We might feel like this is too big of an issue. Yet from God's perspective, He has committed to us to be with us, never to abandon us. And His will here is to keep with us until we're finally transformed. We also have the resource of Christian community. I'm not precisely sure how you would battle this issue if you didn't have the body of Christ surrounding you for help. We've got that in our wheelhouse. We have counseling and discipleship, really gifted counselors here at this church who can help with this. We also have people who will meet with you weekly in the form of discipleship to help and to pray and to study and to work through these issues. We also pointed out last week we have the family. One of the best tools against pornography is the Christian home, as we'll see here today. We also have countless stories of victory. You know, if we could just get out of porn for 3, 4, 6 months, you would just see it's like the lights come on. And I've counseled one man after another. I think there's a neurochemical component here. The dopamine release, as we studied last week, has an effect. And if you can get those balanced back where they should be, and you can get your mindset on the spirit rather than on the flesh, even if it's only for 3, 4, 5 months, you'll start to see that an issue which had seemed at first to be so difficult and so addictive, you'll see incredible freedom. So we've seen people transformed. We've seen marriages healed. And we've seen that God can definitely work through this. Moreover, we're going to look at the technological piece at the end. Not my particular tool bag, but I talked to some tech nerds this week and they kind of helped me with this, and I'll do my best. Well, By way of introduction, let's look at the subject of discerning porn addiction. One of the difficulties with this topic as a Christian leader or as a parent is that we don't want this issue to be going on for months or even years before somebody gets the insight that there's a problem here. We don't want to just let it sit, you know, and grow and metastasize, so to speak, but we want to be able to discern the subject of porn addiction in our loved ones. Well, the number one key to discernment biblically is to look at the person's deeds. It's one thing to look at a person's words. It's another to look at a person's works. We know that works, if we're looking at an iceberg, 10% is above the surface. Surely there's a lot beneath the surface that's happening. But what we're seeing above the surface of the water, so to speak, is a person's deeds and works and lifestyle. And this will give us tremendous insight into what's happening in that person's life. So Jesus teaches us this. He says, wisdom is vindicated by her deeds, by what the person does, not necessarily what the person says. Matthew 11:19. Jesus critiqued the Pharisees. He says, they say things, but they do not do them. We don't want to raise a generation of Pharisees that are really good talkers, but they don't actually live out a Christian life. 1 John chapter 2, verse 6, John writes this. He says, the one who says he abides in him ought himself to walk in the same manner as he walked. So does your walk match your talk? And discernment really comes at this key point here. Now, it isn't that we're only looking at the person's deeds, but that's a key insight into what's happening in the person's heart. So we look at different signs of pornography use. I'm getting this from Wendy Maltz's excellent book, The Porn Trap, as well as Mark Lasser's book, Healing the Wounds of Sexual Addiction. What are some signs somebody could be in porn? For one, relational distance, relational alienation, where you start to sense that this person just isn't connecting with other people. Why could that be? You know, porn use brings in a tremendous amount of shame and guilt. And so when we're in that state, just think of Adam in the garden. As soon as he falls into sin, he runs from God. He blames his wife. Our habitual sin nature is to hide, is to flee from people around us. They also argue laziness. You know, the person who is truly addicted to pornography is incredibly lazy most of the time. They also make the caveat that this could lead to a high achiever, an overachiever, because they have so much deep, dark stuff in their closet, they're trying to make up for it out in the public square. That's possible too. What I've seen, laziness. You aren't stimulated by a girlfriend, by a career, by a job, by friendships, talking to another person, getting up out of bed in the morning. I mean, the stimulation which pornography offers is just incredibly more than the stimulation of a quiet, calm, though satisfying conversation with another person. Anxiety, depression, anger, the porn user will typically, as you get closer, as you start to ask questions, will get really angry with you. Makes sense? Because what this is doing is you're getting into their issues, you're getting into the sludge in their heart, and this is really a natural reaction here, that you're going to react against it in a self-protective sense. Attention deficit disorder. This comes up in the studies repeatedly. That as soon as you become mind-numbed with porn, all of a sudden, sitting down to do some reading or to do some study or to pay attention in a Bible study It's just kind of like the tryptophan after Thanksgiving. You just can't quite keep your eyes open. Highly sexualized humor. This is a sign. Now, if you know me, you know, I like to cut it up like everyone else, okay? And I don't have the cleanest mouth, okay? Public confession. And I don't want to get legalistic here, where all of a sudden somebody makes a crude joke and we're looking, porn use. This is a sign. This doesn't mean it's true. It just means there could be something happening here. Mark Lasser gives the example. You're sitting in coffee and you're talking to your friend and you say something like, I just got off at 5 o'clock today. And he leans in and he says, you got off? You got off at 5 o'clock? Yeah, I got off work at 5 o'clock. If every statement is being spun towards something which is sexual, it starts to make you wonder. You know, Jesus taught in Luke chapter 6, verse 45, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so this is something we should keep an eye open for, keep an ear open for. Also, history of abuse. Abuse affects people in different ways. But as we'll see, abuse is almost constantly connected with sexual addiction and porn use. Now, for each of these signs here, I'm sure you're thinking to yourself, well, wait a minute. So you're saying if somebody has these signs, they're a porno addict? No, I'm not saying that. You could have all six of these signs and never look at porn. Okay? I'm not saying that if you have these signs, it's necessarily the case that you're into porn. These are subjective. These are subjective signs which should lead us to dig deeper. Like we noted last week, if there's a lot of smoke, there must be a fire. And if we see a bunch of these signs here, what is it that's causing that? It could be multifactorial. It could be a number of different things. We know that. One of the causes could be porn use. I like Jimmy Stewart's movie from the 50s. Can you tell I'm really trying to be contextual for the adults here? Trying really hard. Jimmy Stewart's movie Rear Window, the Alfred Hitchcock film, where both of his legs are broken and he's got the binoculars and he's looking out the window and he's looking at the apartment complex on the other side of the street. And he's got the binocs out and he's looking over and he sees shadows which are suspicious. And then he sees, or he hears noises, and then he sees a man with a knife, and then he sees him carrying out a bag to the dumpster the next morning. And each one of these installments, each one of these suspicious signs, you might say, they're not proof that his neighbor is a murderer. But this is illustrative of discernment. You know, if you are hearing strange noises next door at your neighbor's, you wouldn't go over and kick down the door, okay, and pull out your gun and say, what's the problem? No. But what you would do is investigate. You'd go over and knock. Maybe you'd call the police, have them investigate. The same thing is true here. As you start to see these red flags, move toward the person. Dig deeper. Now, this might sound like what we're doing is just advocating for negativity. That if there's issues, what are we being suspicious here? We're trying to bust each other. Discernment isn't the same as negativity. For one, negativity comes from Satan. Satan wants you to feel like, you know, everyone's a suspect. Everyone around you can't change, and negativity actually makes some people not want to get in with people at all, because you can just sense the overwhelming weight of what it's like to get into people's stuff and to help out. Discernment comes from God. God will give you insight as you pray, as you move closer to the individual, and he's going to start to show you, you know, I think there is an issue here. Asking the right questions. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13:7, love believes in all things. Love believes in all things. You know, negativity refuses to agree with that verse. It's looking at a person just saying, I can't believe in this person. They're too far gone. They're too messed up. They're too broken. Maybe even personal frustration sets in where, you know, I've been working with this person for 2, 3, 4 years. Nothing's changing. That's negativity. You know, discernment isn't like that. Yet, it rejoices in the truth. Isn't it interesting that those two different verses are paired, that love believes in all things, having faith in people, believing in people, yet you rejoice with the truth at the same time? This must mean that you're not just, you know, Pollyanna, where you can't be disturbed from your optimism. You have to look at the facts, face the facts. That's one of the keys to discernment. Negativity is fatalistic. The person will never change. Discernment isn't optimistic. It's not pessimistic. It's realistic. We're actually going to get a real, honest assessment of what's happening in this person's life. Negativity usually causes us to retreat from the person or to blow up on the person out of frustration. We've just been holding back passively for so long that eventually it just wells up inside and it turns into some kind of unrighteous rebuke session. It really has less to say about that person, has more to say about me. I'm frustrated. I'm impatient. Discernment moves toward the person. Moving toward the person persistently, we're constantly increasing the level at which we're coming after this issue. Negativity is usually because of emotional and personal hurt that, you know, I've been slighted, I've invested this time, I've raised you for 16 years, how dare you? And really, negativity is more about me than it is about the person. Discernment is not this way. It's getting the picture so that under grace, secure in my identity in Christ, I can move toward this person and start to help. Well, as we think about counseling this issue of porn use, we want to look at the improper approach. If you're familiar with the different types of Christian counseling, this would be like nouthetic counseling, made popular by Jay Adams. It's, you look at the wrong action. Okay, you're in porn. Okay, switch over to don't be in porn. Stop. Okay, so what we're going to do, you know, in some colleges who adopt this view, they'll get a rubber band around your hand. And every time you want to think of porn, you pull back the rubber band and snap it. Okay, that's as deep as they go. Okay, maybe coming up with action plans. Everything is imperative focused. Do this. Don't do that. Okay, and if we're thinking about this like an iceberg, yeah, porn use is bad. It's really bad. And we want to get to stage two. We want to get over that huge hurdle and get people out of porn. Actions matter. Behavior matters. It does. So in a sense, this approach is partially true. The problem is it's totally false. It's a half-truth. We would take a different approach. Instead of just looking at the deeds, what's above the surface, we're going to dig deeper. Okay, so we're going to look at the wrong actions. And then we're going to get into this 90% sludge and crap underneath the surface, which the Bible refers to as our false beliefs. Think of Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9. The heart, he says, is deceitfully wicked. Who could understand it? But then verse 10, I, the Lord, search the heart. The Lord will move in. He'll start to work through all of these false beliefs. And the truth is, he's going to do that through you. you're going to play a role here to get into some of those false beliefs. We're going to attack these false belief systems with true beliefs. And then we're going to pray and we're going to hope and we're going to counsel and we're going to exhort. We might even rebuke if necessary to get to the point where we're moving toward right actions. So it's an indirect approach that we're putting forward here. So in the first stage, wrong actions, we've discerned either the person has come out with their issue or they've been busted, which so often happens. And so now we've been sent in to start to work with this person and give them some of the help that they need. First thing we want to do is don't panic. Don't freak out, okay? They're in porn. It's come out. Okay. You panicking isn't going to help the situation. Get yourself under control. Build rapport with the individual. All good Christian counseling and leadership is based on relationship with the person. Do they trust you? Have you invested your life in their life? Do they feel like they can actually open up and talk about these issues? Try not to moralize. You know, the first thing you don't want to do is just to talk about how wrong this is. Moralizing, okay, let's let them talk first. Let's let them build a case for how this has been affecting them. Maybe they already know. How about that? Maybe the Holy Spirit has already been doing work on their heart, and they themselves already know how wrong this is, how much it's hurt people. Let's try and get at some of those issues first. Get them talking. We want to see, okay, are they rationalizing this issue? Are they looking at pornography and saying, okay, it's really not that big of a deal. My wife is okay with it. They're justifying it. You know, she hasn't slept with me for 6 months, and so I deserve this. Justification. Rationalization, blame shifting. It's her fault. It's his fault. It was the test I failed. It was my car broke down and I was sad. And so I just couldn't help but look at porn for 2 hours. Blame shifting, minimizing, exaggerating. Are you getting the gist here? We're trying to look at just how deep does this go? Control efforts. How is it that the person has been dealing with this issue themselves and failing? What do you think is going to help deal with this issue? Well, at this point, we're just trying to get an assessment. So think of Sherlock Holmes going into the murder scene. He's not trying to figure out who the murderer is. He's trying to collect data. Okay, that tobacco has been burning for so long. Footprint. Blood on his sleeve. He's just collecting the data in order to make an assessment. That's the first stage. Eventually, we want to dig even deeper into the person's false beliefs. You know, this is biblical. The Bible spills a ton of ink, not just on what we're doing wrong, which there would be plenty to talk about there if the Bible so chose to do that. But instead, the Bible focuses more on the renewing of our mind. Paul says you will be transformed. Metamorpho is the Greek. Metamorphosis. You're going to go through a metamorphosis. How? By just behaviorism? By just changing? By just snapping the rubber band on your wrist? No, wrong. It's going to be through the renewing of your mind that your false beliefs will change and transfer into true beliefs. Now, quick caveat. Consequences can produce change. Okay? We don't want to overstate this. If your boss says to you Monday morning, you need to get here on time, and by on time I mean 7 a.m. tomorrow, or you're fired. You think that would get you there on time the next morning? I think it would get me there on time for the next couple weeks at least, right? If your landlord says, if the rent is late again, I'm kicking you out. Yeah, you don't need the Holy Spirit to be able to react to that kind of a fear threat. You will get that money in pronto. It isn't the consequences. It isn't the fear threat doesn't produce change. What we're saying here is that it produces minimal change. The project that we're under here is to be transformed into a selfless, loving, confident, Christ-like person. You can't get there through fear threat. We're talking about a whole project, not just on your behavior, but on your person, on your personhood, to change you to be altruistically loving other people. And no, that doesn't get accomplished by fear threat. So while that can produce some change, it's just not good enough. It's not what we're after here. We're after people not just faking it, not just playing by the rules. We're after people actually having an encounter with God and being changed from the heart. So here's some common false beliefs. It's not hurting anybody. Okay? It's just me in my bedroom with my laptop or my phone. You know, we didn't even get into all of the different testimonies of the women that have come out of the porn industry. Some of them are so graphic. I wouldn't feel comfortable reading them in public. I do have articles on this if you'd like to read what it's actually like to be involved in this process from women who have left this industry and eventually come to Christ. They tell their testimony, their story. Put quite frankly, it is hurting people. You're participating in a business which is vile, which is evil, and which is wrong. It's chewing up women like meat in a grinder. And it is hurting people. And even if it's not hurting them, maybe they're a willing participant. Why don't you tell yourself that? I hope you can believe that. Yeah, they're just a willing participant and they love it. Even if it isn't hurting them, it's hurting you and it's hurting the relationships you have around you. I deserve this. What makes you think that? You know, I just felt like, you know, I've been going through such a tough time and that's when I had my fall. Why is it that whenever people are going through intense stress, sometimes intense victory, that's when people are most weak to fall into pornography? That they feel like either they're stressed out so they deserve it, or maybe they've led their whole city block to Christ, and afterward they say to themselves, I feel like I deserve to dabble here a little bit. We got to argue against that. Everybody does it. I'll stop when I have a girlfriend or a wife. I've heard that before. I said, brother, I've counseled adult men who immediately after having sex with their wife will go and look at pornography. I hope you don't think that you'll just be able to give this up like it's just going to evaporate, that you've been bonding to porn for years, but now you have a wife and that's going to change it. I hope I'm wrong, but that's not the experience I've seen. It's not what the Bible predicts either. Okay, let's dig down even deeper into the issues of identity. You do know that porn is more than just about lust, right? If it was just about lust, porn use would last all of 3, 4, 5 minutes. What we discover is that porn use lasts for hours for some people. They're looking for that right picture. They're looking for that right video, that right scene, that right graphic image. If this was just about the physiological, biological component, it wouldn't fit the picture. Instead, we have to go after the ego needs of the person. So we can think of significance that when I'm feeling like a loser at work, when I'm feeling like a loser at school, when I've been turned down for the third time for a date. Going to porn gives me a sense of significance. Admiration. Desire. You could think of feeling appreciated, feeling loved. Oh, this is way deeper than just saying, stop it. Stop doing porn. You know, the best strippers, prostitutes, and porn stars have this ability to make the viewer feel wanted. You know, it isn't just about, let's just get the deed done. It's more about, can I look at you in such a way that makes you feel like manly? You know, you look at these pictures of women, even lingerie women, you know, they always have these looks like, you know, you're all going to have nightmares now. Maybe that'll keep you out of pornography. Picturing that ugly mug looking at you like that. Why is it that they all look that way? Why is it that they all have to have that excited look? It's because men want that. Men want to feel like someone loves me, like I'm important, like I'm manly, like someone desires me, that I'm important. Oh, man. If we could get after many of these ego needs here, the thrill of porn, I'm not saying it would go away, but this would take away a bunch of that sting. Family of origin. Important with any kind of counseling. I will say you don't want to get morbidly introspective on this about how everything in your family was messed up. Okay? But we want to go back here. We want to see how we were affected, how we were hurt, how we were modeled, love, nurture. You know, for some people, perhaps they grew up in a really critical home where everything is really critical and everything has to be by the book. Sex for a person like that can be very difficult because sex is incredibly vulnerable. And so they might actually be aversive to sex. And so they don't want to get near sex because they don't want to feel like they're underneath the microscope. But as a result, pornography might feel like an escape from that. You know, a household where love wasn't communicated, physical touch wasn't communicated. Lasser points out that might be a way of self-soothing. Pornography becomes a way to be touched in some kind of loving way for yourself because you never were touched that way. You never experienced that comfort from your parents. And I think it's good to point out, this would include those of us who grew up in homes which were not Christian. It would include those of us who grew up in homes that are Christian. This is one of the most confusing parts for kids who grew up in Christian homes. Because, you know, you start to talk about family of origin and they're like, oh, not me. I grew up in a Christian home. Yeah, you. You grew up in a home with sinful people and sinful parents. Lasser puts it this way. He says, labeling a family as either healthy or unhealthy isn't even necessarily helpful. Many Christians get stuck in black and white thinking, trying to decide if their families are good or bad. Look it. All families have good and bad, healthy and unhealthy qualities. All families and all family members make mistakes. A lot of times, your sons and daughters look at you and they're like, oh man, mom and dad, you know, they're like the second coming of Christ. I remember them reading their Bible and maybe they even led a home church and they put you up on this pedestal, a pedestal you don't feel comfortable being on, right? But they can't see how things may or may not have been unhealthy. And they have to be able to wade through that. Abuse, here's a shocking statistic from Dr. Patrick Carnes, who's a real authority on sexual addiction. He says 97% of sex addicts were emotionally abused, 81% were sexually abused, 74% physically abused. So this is going much deeper than just lust this is going into deep areas of our identity, our core values, everything like that. And it's going to affect people in different ways. To that, I would just say, I would get a hold of a good Christian counselor. You can help. You can wade into these issues. But abuse, it isn't monolithic. It isn't like, well, they were abused and so they're going to have this reaction. Okay? It's very diverse, very confusing. It takes a ton of prayer. The point here is that we're trying to get at the root, not just the fruit. Well, this brings us to stage three, focusing on true beliefs. You know, here we're going to pray. We're going to try and exhort this person. Remember Hebrews 10:24, consider how you might stimulate one another to love and good deeds. The imperative there is to consider, is to think. Stop and think and pray. What am I going to say this week? Lord, I haven't prayed for this guy all week long, and I'm meeting with him in an hour. But that leaves me an hour to pray and get some kind of a plan. What questions am I going to ask? What truths am I going to bring to the surface? Prepare in advance. Get help from Christian counselors. Do some kind of reading. The reason I got a burden for this topic is because I was just counseling so many different men who were knee-deep in porn. And I didn't know what I was doing. I still am not sure I know what I'm doing. But after reading a couple books, you start to get more of a understanding of what the psychology is and how it affects the person, and et cetera, et cetera. If your person is having an issue, do some reading on it. Get some books open. Here, we're bringing the truth about the false beliefs. You know, remember that list. Significance. Admiration. Being desired. Being loved. All of those things are wrapped up in our identity in Christ. Even family of origin. You've been given a new family of origin. You've been given a new father. You've been given new relationships. And so we're trying to discover here, is this person ignorant to these truths? Maybe they've just never read them. That's a distinct possibility. You might be assuming, well, this person knows what I'm talking about. How do you know? Maybe you just need to go through some of these passages or give them to them as a homework assignment. Hey, I got, you know, 10 verses. I was hoping you'd read these this week and you come back and give me some of your insights on it. We should never feel insecure about bringing up the same truths. Peter didn't feel this way. 2 Peter 1:13, he says, I consider it right to stir you up by way of reminder. You know, one of the ways Satan attacks us is that we're coming in with an old identity truth. Man, this person's 30 years in the Lord. They've heard this identity truth before. Who cares? They need to hear it again and again and again. Think of the Israelites, just how many times God would speak to them, give them miracles, and then, you know, a generation later, they totally forgot. The same thing is happening here. You know, every single day you wake up, it's like memento. You forget who you are, where you came from, where you're going. You forget that you have people who love you. You forget that you have a heavenly Father. And these things need to be repeated and dwelled upon. Yeah, the question isn't if they know biblical truth. Well, I know that. I know that identity truth. Okay, congratulations. You know it. The question is, are you dwelling on it? Are you trusting in that truth? Well, I've read it before. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, do you believe it? Do you trust it? Do you dwell in it? What does that verse mean to you? What does that truth mean to you? Well, finally, the goal is a changed life. I get really suspicious of people who are saying, oh man, God's been revealing all this stuff to me, and I'm just understanding His grace to a much deeper degree, and all this. And then you're like, awesome. And then, you know, months go by and nothing ever changes. You know, the grace of God comes into our lives, according to Titus 2, so that we would get away from ungodliness. One of the signs that you really are being worked over is by virtue of the fact that you're changing. You're turning into a more Christ-like person. But here, what we're trying to do is get them to live out that identity, not just believe it in some abstract, esoteric way. But if this was really true, that you are a child of God, that you have been given incommensurable significance and love, and in Ephesians 1:3, that He's given us every spiritual gift, meaning if God wanted to give anything else, He couldn't, because He's exhausted everything that He can. If that was really true, how would your life change? You know, our actions do matter. We're not saying that we're not Gnostics here, where we just say, well, I'm forgiven in my soul, so it doesn't matter what I do in my body. That's Gnosticism. That's not Christianity. We do think it matters, but the role, the way to get to it, is indirect, not direct. That's the difference between true biblical counseling and legalism, that we're trying to get at these false beliefs. System. So here, try and help them create a plan of action. Where do you fall into it? Well, every time I fall into it, it's at night and it's in my bed and it's on my phone. Okay, let's talk about that. When do you fall into it? Well, whenever I get bad news. You know, there's a guy I was working with that I could almost predict, you know, if something really bad happened in his life. His girlfriend dumped him. He failed the test. His car broke down. I could almost predict that week he was going to fall into porn, because he couldn't deal with stress. He had never learned how to deal with that. And so when it finally, once we started to work on those issues, we started to see some ground being made. So come up with some kind of a plan. Break down steps into manageable parts. So here, okay, we're trying to replace this with something. How about you go out and love somebody of the same sex and pour into their lives? And so the next week they show up and they say, how'd it go? Well, couldn't do it. Okay, don't love them. Just talk to them. Okay, I'm just going to talk. And they come back and they say, I couldn't do it. Okay, get their phone number. Get their phone number. You can do that. Every human being can do that. Get their phone number. Okay. I couldn't do that. Okay. This week, just say hi. Can you say hi? We're going to keep taking those steps. You know, building a friendship for somebody might be really hard. They don't know how to do that. They might be a total, you know, basket case, and they don't know how to build into someone's life. Break the step in half. If they still can't do it, break the step in half. There's going to be a certain point at which, if somebody isn't taking any kind of steps, we're going to have to come in with some sort of authority and speak powerfully to them. Look, you couldn't do this, so we broke it down. You couldn't do that, so we broke it down. Now I'm just telling you to do anything, and you won't do it. My friend, do you really want to change? Or are you wasting my time and your time? You know, I won't be on your case about this if you don't want to change. But let me know, because if you're really here to be serious, you got to show up with something. Give me something. I'm trying to believe in you here. Come up with options for resist and replace. You know, Paul says, flee these childish things, flee immorality, flee youthful lusts is the language. With those who call on the name of the Lord with a pure heart. So it's not just fleeing something you're addicted to. It's also moving toward those who call on the name of the Lord with a pure heart. That'd be Christian community. And we've got that. So are they moving toward other people? You know, one of the issues here is that pornography is a relational issue. It's a relational deficit. And if we could provide the warmth of the Christian community in relational love. That's going to take so much of the sting out of porn use. You can also give them homework assignments. This is a good way to discern, are they really trying to change? You know, for somebody who's trying to change but failing, I mean, they're trying, but they just keep messing up. I would be infinitely patient if they just show up each week with their head in their hands. I did it again. Did you try? Did you try and take steps? I did try. Okay, we're going to try again. And we're going to pray again. And we're going to go through the truths again. Somebody who's not doing anything. Okay, that's where we actually have to bring what the Bible calls rebuke. Or some kind of increased level of, do you realize you're heading off a cliff? But we can give homework assignments here. For one, have them write a short, emphasis on short, short autobiography. I don't want to read Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities about your life. You're just not that interesting of a person, right? I honestly don't care that much, okay? But just give me the highs and lows of your life. What were moments where you just felt totally loved? What are moments you felt totally significant? What are moments you felt totally accepted? What are moments you felt totally broken? What are moments you felt totally alienated, abandoned? You felt like a failure? Get them to think through this, and then they can come back and you can discuss and start working through. When did this habit begin? Life goals. One of the things for the porn addict is they don't feel like they have any kind of direction in life. And so they go back to pornography for safety. What are those? Do you want a career? Do you want a family? Do you want a spouse? Hopefully not in that order, but life goals. Feelings journal. This is helpful, especially for men, also for counseling women on porn use. Men, for me, I didn't know this until I got married, but I only had two emotions. Frustrated or pissed. So my wife would come to me, so how does that make you feel? And I'd be like, pissed? Okay, tell me more. Tell me more. Frustrated. That's better than my family. A lot of people I grew up with was frustrated, pissed, or drunk. So I guess I'm moving in there. Everyone went, ooh. Feelings journal. What this will do is actually give teeth to how someone's feeling. Okay, you know there's more emotions than three, right? Okay, anxious, worried, depressed, fearful. You're trying to give different options. Okay, and let's talk about that. Okay, if they get a journal going, then they could say, I fell into porn here on Thursday night. Okay, let's look at Wednesday. What happened Wednesday? Oh, you failed your test. Oh, you got in a fight with your spouse on Wednesday. Oh, you got a promotion, demoted at work. Oh, okay, so we're seeing something here. You don't know how to deal with X, Y, or Z, which is leading to the issue. For many people, giving them some kind of a cost-benefit analysis for change. So one guy I was counseling, this is back before the iPhone and the smartphone, he would fall into it on his computer. And so we had him put a post-it note up in the corner of his computer, and it had his spouse's name. It had people whom he was mentoring, making an impact for Christ. It had some of his life goals, pretty short, but every single time he opened up his computer, he got to see that. You know, if I'm going to have a fall here, it's not just affecting me. It's affecting her, it's affecting him, and it's affecting this. And what it does is it starts to get the portion of the brain which regulates thought and rationality involved in this portion of the brain that just moves you toward urges, like you're an animal, like the reptilian brain. Okay, just have sex, and that's the drive that's moving. And if you can get the front prefrontal cortex working, how is this going to affect people and get yourself thinking? It helps quite a bit. Maybe get some kind of a time spent assessment. I don't know about you, but if I was working 15 hours per week, not going to school, and sleeping in until 3 p.m. every day, I would have a porn problem. I don't know if that's true of every person in this room, but I know that that's true of me. And I suspect it's also true of you. You can't be sitting around with hours on your hands and just thinking, I can't figure out why I'm having such a porno issue. It's because you need to get a job. It's because you need to get out and go to school and do something with that time. I've got one friend that just keeps himself so busy. He's like, man, I don't have time to look at porn. I got too much going on in my life. I'm like, you know, that's good. It's healthy. Most importantly, we get this from Ralph Ankinman. Emphasize love output. Do you know what the biggest change I've seen in men? I can't speak for women here. But the biggest change I've seen in men on this issue, you know, sometimes we'll study it, we'll go through the false belief systems, we'll do the true beliefs, we'll work in, we'll pray, and it isn't until they start to think about how to give out love to other people that we see a change. In fact, I've seen that in case after case. One guy, we were studying this topic for 6 months. He went on vacation and he read Watchman Nee's book, The Normal Christian Life. That's the commentary. Dennis calls himself Watchman Nee's interpreter for Walking in Victory. Basically says a lot of those illustrations I got just straight from Nee. Well, if you go back and read that book, that is a deep spiritual text on our identity in Christ. Anyhow, he read that book. He thought about his identity. And he came back and he said, you know what, I'm just not going to focus on this freaking issue. And I'm just going to get out and love people. And sure enough, within a month, he didn't have a single fall. This was a guy, by the way, he was having falls 3 or 4 times a day. Now, totally transformed, and it was because of this. Let's get the focus off of me, myself, and I, and my porn problem. Why don't I start thinking about other people out there who need help? Well, this is going to lead to slow, gradual change. I know in charismatic circles, they will just pray the demon of pornography out of you. And I really do wish it worked that way. It doesn't. It is slow, painstaking change. During this period, we're urging the person to trust in truth more than feelings. We're taking note of their progress. We're asking them to recount earlier convictions. You know, for here, for example, maybe the person is looking at it 3 or 4 times a day, and then they go a week without looking at it. That's progress. That should be celebrated. Okay, are they still in the thick of it? Are they still in big trouble, you know, watching porn once a week? Yes, you are. That is not going to give you a long enough break to get out of this. But at least it's progress. There's something I can show up with and encourage. Hey, dude, a couple months ago you were into this, you know, 3 hours a day. Now you had one fall last week. Come on. You can do this. Never agree with Satan's accusations. A terrible story. A girl who was struggling with pornography. She had been struggling with it for a couple years, showed up to one of the girls she was being mentored by. And she said, you know, I just keep struggling with pornography and I just don't feel like anything has changed. And I just feel like I haven't changed, and I just don't really feel like anything has moved forward. And the other girl turned to her and said, you know what? I think that's true. I really don't think that you have put any effort into this. You really haven't changed. That week, that girl left fellowship. You know, that could have been true. It could have been true that she hadn't put any effort into it. That's possible. More likely is the fact that Satan was bringing her that accusation, you know, give up. It's not worth even trying. And we, out of personal frustration and anger, it's hard showing up looking this person in the eye every week and nothing has changed, or you don't feel like they're moving as quickly as you want them to. It's hard, but never agree with Satan that nothing. Is there something you could point to? Okay, even if you're still falling, but you've learned some things about yourself, you've gotten better tools, so is there something we can encourage? Here's a way of thinking about this. This is from Patrick Carnes, who's an authority on sexual addiction. If there's one thing you could take from this morning, this is it. Patrick Carnes explains it this way. He says the person who is a porn user, they're dealing with this constellation of issues. Shame, guilt, anxiety, depression, laziness, anger. And they don't know how to deal with that. They're not mature enough to deal with that. They don't know how to process those feelings. They don't know how to. This is the person that just blows up and explodes into tears or in anger. They don't know how to deal with that. And so as a result, they're sitting in class at 3 p.m. at Ohio State, and they're thinking to themselves, man, my life sucks. I feel guilty. I feel anxious. I feel depressed. I feel lazy. I'm not going anywhere. And Karn says this leads to the first stage, which is preoccupation. I don't want to think about how guilty I feel. I don't want to think about the fact that my life isn't going anywhere. I can't deal with that. That's too big of a weight to carry. And so they start to preoccupy themselves. You know, I want to think about something good. And so they start thinking about ways in which they can self-soothe. And this leads to the second stage, the ritual stage. And so again, the guy, 3 p.m., Ohio State class, is sitting there in class, and this lecture's boring. I'm feeling guilty. I'm feeling like my life isn't going anywhere. And so he starts to ritualize what he's about to do. He starts to think, okay, I'm going to get home. Let's see. I'm going to get home at 4:30. My roommate will be gone. He won't be back until 7. He'll be at the gym. I'm going to be in my bed. I'm going to pretend to sleep. I'm going to pull out my cell phone, and that's when I'm going to have a good hour to myself for porn. When the person finally reaches the third stage, having a fall, most people, men and women, feel like they were just a complete zombie. Carnes tells the stories of men who go and solicit prostitution. And he says, you know, they're taking a trip out of town away from their wife, and it's in 2 weeks, and they've already planned where they're going to rent their car, where they're going to stop at the ATM, how they're going to get the cash, what neighborhood they're going to go to, what motel they're going to go to, how they're going to pay for it, who they're going to pick. And so by the time they finally get to the city, they feel like a zombie. They feel like they were on autopilot. By the time they have the fall, they wake up in bed and they're like, I don't know how that happened. It happened under the ritual stage. It happened because you've been planning this for weeks. Now, that stage, the ritual stage, it could last a minute. It could last an hour. It could last a week. Maybe for some of us, your spouse is going out of town next weekend, or in 2 weeks, or in 2 months. She's going on a retreat or getting away with the girls or the guys for the weekend. And so you're already planning how you're going to have your fall. I'm going to have the house to myself. The kids will be gone. Well, after you have the fall, it's like you're thirsty and drinking a tall glass of salt water. It doesn't quench. Instead, it only makes it worse, which brings you back to shame, guilt, emotional problems, which you've never dealt with. You don't know how to deal with that. And so you're thinking about your last fall. You're thinking about your life. You're thinking about this boring professor talking to you. And you fall into stage number one, preoccupation. I don't want to think about that. You see the vicious cycle? Here is where we should attack it. First, dealing with emotional maturity, working through how do I process this pain and these issues up here. But second, ritual. We've got to target the ritualizing. If you start to ritualize, that's the red flag. Okay? You might be able to stop by the grace of God once you finally get into the place where you're going to have a fall. But if you could stop it here, that's going to nip it right in the bud. Okay. I'm concerned about time. So I'm just going to keep pressing forward. Okay? And we're going to do questions at the end. Cool? Do you guys need a break? Okay, good. I wasn't going to give you one anyhow. What do you do when your spouse is in porn? I'm trying to be as gender neutral as possible. I know I'm failing. I'm trying. I met a girl after Saturday's talk. She came up and she said, "You better emphasize the women this week. Women are in porn." I said, "Oh, yeah?" She said, "I lead a high school group. We've got 9 girls. 5 of them are in porn." I'm trying to be gender neutral. So if I say it's the husband in porn and the wife is the one not in porn, please just, you're going to have to be my interpreter. But I'm going to do my best. What happens when your spouse is in porn? A question that often gets asked. First, be thankful that it's finally surfaced. I know that this isn't exactly the most intuitive feeling to have, to be thankful. One way of thinking about this is, would you rather know what the problem is, or would you rather be blissfully ignorant? In the short term, it's going to hurt more. In the long term, maybe you could actually save your marriage. You know, would you rather know if you had a lump or you had something that was suspicious of being cancer, would you rather know what it is and start to deal with it? Or would you rather just ignore it? You know, the same thing is true here. Usually in retrospect, the spouse realizes, you know, something has been funky with my spouse for a long time. Something's been wrong. And in retrospect, they feel kind of foolish because it's all clear. All the pieces come together. Hindsight's 20/20. But be thankful that it's finally out in the open where we can deal with it. Secondly, share your hurt feelings with your spouse in the right way and in the right context. What I mean by that is this. When your spouse confesses to you that they have been in porn, it's going to be an absolute blizzard in your mind, I'm assuming. And it's going to be painful. And it's going to be confusing. And you're going to feel hurt. I'm just trying to say, do your best to hit pause and not explode on your spouse in the moment. This is why. Because when they make that confession to you, you have both legitimate and illegitimate feelings. The legitimate hurt feelings, you have broken my trust. We're one flesh. What you do privately affects me. This is affecting our relationship. You've kept this in the dark. You've kept this hidden from me. Those are legitimate hurt feelings. But let me say, in these moments, there's also illegitimate hurt feelings. The women that we've seen counseled on this topic, one of the biggest things that comes up is insecurity. because their husband has been looking at pornography, and all of a sudden they want to know what he's been looking at. And how do they compare to those women in those videos he's been watching? The difficulty here, okay, there's a difficulty in the fact that it's possible, it's very possible, you could be taking your identity from what the world says about sex. Insofar as you think that my identity is wrapped up in how I look, and I don't compare to those women. That's a whole nother problem you're going to have to work through. So in other words, let me put it this way. His sin has now just invoked both your righteous indignation as well as your sin. And that's all coming out at once in a moment. And all I would say is just take your time to process how you're feeling before you explode. Is it possible for you to share your hurt feelings without punishing him? Is it possible for you to, if not, take some time to process? What I call it is debriefing with God. Whenever something traumatic or difficult happens to me and my wife says, "How'd that make you feel?" And I go, I don't know. What I do is I open up the prayer journal and I start to write out how I'm feeling. And why am I feeling that way? It's way more difficult than you think if you've never tried it before. Take some time to process. I guess what I'm driving at here is if he has finally opened up and confessed, we don't want to punish him for that. Okay? He needs help. Okay, he's in sin. He is messed up bad. Is there a way that you can share constructively how you're feeling rather than destructively? If you explode on him, in other words, do you think he'd be willing to open up about this again? That would be a difficulty. So in other words, take your time. Open up to other women in your life. Talk to God about this. And finally, get help. Please don't keep this a secret where, okay, we're just going to work through this. Galatians chapter 6 teaches that each one of us should bear one another's loads and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. It's talking about this. You know, he needs help. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to fix him. That's not our role as a spouse. Why don't you get some other strong Christian men involved, where they can talk to him and counsel him. Now, when you are the spouse in porn, first things first, forget everything I just said about your spouse's reaction. Why? It's like I'm writing two different letters here. I just wrote a letter to her, and that's her mail, and she gets to read that. Now I'm writing a letter to you, and you get to read your mail. What we wouldn't want to do is try and control how my spouse can or can't react to me when I confess such a life-changing event as being addicted to porn. I wouldn't want a single person leaving here, going home and confessing to their spouse and saying, "I've been in porn," and their spouse blows up and starts crying and they say, "Oh, you can't react that way. That's unrighteous." Dude, okay, you made your bed. You're going to have to sleep in it. Okay, they might blow up, they might weep, they might be hysterical. Okay, is that totally righteous of them? No, but you're going to have to deal with that because what you did just provoked that. So I hope they could keep it under control and partner with you on this issue. At the same time, they might not. And you're just going to have to eat a poop sandwich at that point. Break the silence. You know, you're going to have to talk about this at one point or another. David says this in Psalm 32. He says, "When I refused to confess my sin, my body wasted away and I groaned all day long." You ever been here? You ever had something on your conscience where you're just, I don't know if I've groaned audibly, but you just feel that in your soul, man. oh, God, I know I need to share this. The Holy Spirit will even give us direction on this. He'll say, you need to share it to Him. And you'll just think, oh, I just don't want to share it to Him. And it's that groaning day and night. Your hand of discipline was heavy upon me. My strength evaporated like water in the summer heat. You see what he's saying there? You're so emotionally wrapped up with the fact that you're trying to keep this hidden that all your strength is going into that. And so you're irritable as anything. You don't have anything else to give out. It's because you're trying to play this protective game where I'm trying to protect myself from anybody finding out. Proverbs records this. It says, he who conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion. Isn't it interesting whenever we open up with a group of brothers, sisters about our issues, 2 seconds before you think this is the worst idea I've ever had in my entire life, 2 minutes after, it starts a chain reaction in the group. Well, if he can talk about it, I guess that means I can talk about it. I've seen this happen where nobody's talking about this subject until somebody breaks the silence. Then all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, I forgot. We're under grace. We get to talk about these kind of things as a group. You'll find compassion. James says, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another so that you may be humiliated. No, so that you may be healed, so you can get the healing that you need. Paul says, no temptation has seized you except what is common to man. You know, when we're stuck in any kind of porn or anything else, the feeling that we have is that we're some kind of freak, abnormal weirdo. Nobody would get it. No one would understand if they only knew the kind of content and the things I've been looking at. And you know, Paul says, you know who would want you to believe that? Satan. You're just too gross. You're too weird. No one would get it. You're the outlier around here. He says, it's common. We're all a bunch of pigs in the slop together. We're all dirty. We all need help. Just open up about it. Let me put it this way. Porn addiction will come out eventually. It's going to come out when you're at work, when you're on your computer. It's going to come out when your spouse busts you and walks into the room. It's going to come out when your kid, who is more intelligent at computers, finds the websites you've been looking at. It's going to come out in one way or another. The question is, how do you want it to come out? Do you want to just end it right now? Or, you know, I can actually come under grace publicly and come forward with this? Or is it that I want to keep this hidden until eventually I get busted on it? I've heard so many embarrassing stories, and I don't even want to share them because I don't want people thinking about who the person is. But people in this fellowship getting busted on it in the most humiliating ways at work, and I better stop there. If you just come out with it in advance, get the healing that you need, you're going to see this is so much better. You're going to see this was the moment at which your marriage changed, your walk changed. One story, the Christian couple where the wife was in pornography, not the husband. She got busted. He found something of hers. She brought it out into the light. You know, up until that point, that couple had been a really spiritually apathetic couple in their group. Until this all came into the light, and that was 6 months ago. 6 months later, she owned it. She started to get transformed, and now that couple is a powerful couple in their home church. You know, this was God's sovereignty to bring that out in that woman's life so she could start getting some of the help that she needed. And all of a sudden, boom, it's like the lights came on. Well, we want to get help too. If we're the spouse in porn, we want to talk to people, get this out in the open. Okay, here's a question you should consider. Should I confess my porn issue to my spouse? Short answer, yes. Long answer is more complex. I know it might just seem like that you should always confess every single time. Okay, I just want to kind of walk through this issue of conscience. Here's my first point. We know that we shouldn't confess every single sin to our spouse. Every single lustful thought, every single critical spirit or attitude, every single time that they mess something up. Why wouldn't we do that? You might say, well, it would be better for your transformation. That's true. It probably would. But it would be so detrimentally unedifying to my wife that I wouldn't do that. I might confess it to a Christian brother. My point here is just to say this is a little bit more complicated than one might think. Okay? What should I confess to my spouse is a little bit complex. Here's some principles. The burden of proof should rest on you as to why you shouldn't. Does that sound fair? If you think that you have some unique reason where I don't feel like I should confess it to her, that better be a really good reason. And you have to bear the full burden of proof there. We should always confess to somebody, whether that's a Christian brother or our spouse or whomever. The spouse should get regular updates. You know, when this issue first comes to light, you should definitely confess it to your spouse. They should know that you're struggling. From there, the question is, do I need to confess this every single time? Or is it a situation in which she or he wants to get regular updates on it? Or does she want to have it happen, come out whenever it happens? Finally, you should discuss this as a couple. So as a couple, okay, let me put it this way. I might be confusing you here. As a couple, I know some couples where the spouse says, I want to be your accountability partner. Okay, cool. If that's what you decide as a couple, fine. For some couples, to see every dirty, gross link that your husband's looking at might not be edifying for you. Okay? As a couple, you might decide, you know, honey, I'd rather have you talk to him about that. And maybe you could give me updates, or he could give me updates every month or so to see how this is going. So I hope that's making sense. You should absolutely confess to your spouse, but how much of a pattern should this be every single fall? You're going to have to discuss that as a couple. Hopefully, your wife or your husband will partner with you, will be able to keep this together emotionally and spiritually so that they can help you with this. I'll just say I've seen examples where one of the spouses, every single confession is such fireworks and there's such vitriol being spewed that it's actually counterproductive at that point. So I hope that gives you some principles of conscience as you work through that. Finally, be patient with your spouse. You know, all of the guilt and the shame that has been carried up on your shoulders for 6 months or 6 years, you've just confessed it to your spouse. And so now what you've done is you've taken that guilt and shame in those feelings and you've passed half of it over to her. And now what's something that you've thought about for months or years, now she's thinking about for the first time. So this becomes difficult as well. Namely because, you know, the guy, let's say, comes out with porn and he's feeling great. He's feeling terrific. And he can't figure out what's wrong with his wife. You know, it's been a month since I confessed and she's still really upset about this. It's because she hasn't processed that. You need to give her time. Be patient. let's talk about how to talk with our kids about this topic. For one, start the conversation when they're young. I'm thinking 6 or 7 years old. We want to reach them. We want to talk to them and educate them about God's view of sex long before they get a metaphorical PhD off the internet from pornographers. So get there first. Explain the positive view of sex that God offers. That this isn't something dirty that we get away from. It's something that mom and I love, and we hope you will love too. I wouldn't go into too many details about that, but just let them know. Mom and I like this, and God likes it, and it's great, but just explain it to them. Never underestimate your influence on your kids. You might be saying to yourself, well, I don't know. I tried talking about this, and it was just so weird that... I think they feel weirder. I think it actually might be stranger if I talk about it more. You know, the data, the research shows kids want more time with their parents, not less. I'm talking about children now, not teenagers, grown-ups. They want more freedom. But children want more time with dad, not less. Josh McDowell tells the story of a little kid. He came up to his father and he said, Dad, how much do you make an hour? And the father said, that's kind of a rude question to ask. And he said, he's probably just trying to get money out of me, you know. And so he said, $100 an hour. And he said, can I have $50? And he said, God, that was so rude. You're just trying to milk me for money. And he yelled at his son and the son ran into his bedroom. Minutes later, the father got himself under control and he walked into the bedroom with the son and he said, you know, I was too harsh on you. I apologize. And he pulled out $50 and he said, here, I'm sorry. Well, the son had $50 under his pillow and he took his $50 and his father's $50 and the dad blew up again. You asked me for $50 and you got $50 under your, and he, well, you know, the fireworks took off and his son started to cry, and he said, what did you want the money for anyhow? And he said, well, you told me that you make $100 an hour, and I've got $100. Could I pay you to eat dinner with the family tonight? You know, I wonder if that isn't illustrative of a lot of our Christian homes. I don't know if someone would actually have to pay. But kids want time with mom. They want time with dad. And we're a huge influence. Kyle Pruitt, medical doctor out of Yale School of Medicine, he says, positive father care is associated with more pro-social and positive moral behavior in boys and girls. The spiritual moral formation begins with the father and the mother in the home. Patricia Draper, she's out of the University of Nebraska, she says, in general, father-absent girls, girls who don't have dads, show precocious sexual interest. You know, precocious, you pick up on things as a young person. Precocious sexual interest, more interest in sex at a younger age. Derogation of masculinity in males, like derogatory, to make them derogated. And poor ability to maintain sexual and emotional adjustment with just one male. And this is directly related to the father's relationship with the daughter. Furstenberg and Harris, out of the University of Pennsylvania, they write this, children who feel a closeness and warmth with their father, twice as likely to enter college, 75% less likely to have a child in their teen years, half as likely to show various signs of depression, 80% less likely to be incarcerated. That last one's a little bit scary. I know James Dobson shares the story of the greeting card company who for Mother's Day had this idea that we would get a stack of greeting cards and we would take it down to the local penitentiary. Well, they brought the greeting cards, and all of the different convicts came up, and they said, free greeting cards for your mom. And Dobson says the line was out the door. They couldn't get enough greeting cards for these felons and convicts. They were just writing out, oh, they just love their mother. They couldn't wait to send this to their mother. And it was such a hit that the warden of the penitentiary said, you know, we should do this for Father's Day, too. They did it for Father's Day. No one showed up. They had a stack of cards for Dad. Nobody knew Dad. Nobody loved Dad. And, you know, I don't think that's just a coincidence. The role of the father in the home is crucial. Here's Thomas and Dzinski out of Johns Hopkins Medical Journal. This is a longitudinal study over 30 years. 1,377 graduates, and they were trying to get at this issue. What is the most likely factor for suicide, mental illness, malignant tumors, cancer, hypertension, and coronary heart disease? If you could just bring it down to one factor that could explain all five of those physical and emotional issues, what would it be? Well, it wasn't diet, thank God. It wasn't exercise, praise Jesus. It was your relationship with your parents in general and your father in particular. I mean, this is out of Johns Hopkins, folks. This isn't out of ChristianFundamentalist.org, right? This is really referring to, why is that? Well, the scientists on this study found that parents are the best resource for measuring stress in their kids' lives. So kids will determine how to measure stress based on how their parents have related with them. So for us, when our little kid is a toddler, when he was first having his first falls as a toddler, he would stumble along and he'd fall down and smack his face right against the concrete, you know. And then he would look up and he would go, and he would look at me. And you know what I'd do? I didn't go, even though that's how I was feeling. I just went, good fall, good fall. And he went, oh. Yeah, he got back up. It got to the point where he would fall. He wouldn't cry. It's not like we wouldn't comfort him if he did cry, but we just didn't panic. And the same thing is true here with parents. If you have a good relationship with your parents, stress produces adrenaline and cortisol in the brain, which are deeply related to all of these different physiological factors. So we're going to have a big influence here, and as teenagers, we're going to have less of an influence. I think our influence retreats a little bit. But it's kind of like a scale. When they're zero, you have 100% influence. By the time they're 18, you might have 10% influence. And it's kind of a scale in between. But we do have a role. Here's something from Josh McDowell. I added reason, but he says this, rules without reason and relationship lead to rebellion. As parents, our influence is based on our relational capital with our kids. This is the best way to be an influence. We take a relational model approach of how to impact children. I still remember listening to an older believer tell a story about this. He says, you know, when I was 17 years old, I was out with a girl I shouldn't have been out with. And we were in a place we shouldn't have been. And she had a joint I shouldn't have been smoking. And he said, I started to think about it. You know, she passed me that joint to smoke it. And he said he looked at it and he was like, man, if I smoked this joint, that would really piss off my dad, who I hate. And so he lit up right there. You know, if we have a love relationship with our father, maybe in those moments of temptation, you might actually have a chance. If you've been so authoritarian in the home that your kids fear you rather than love you, that's not really going to produce long-lasting change. that works up until they hit their preteens. And then it's going to run right off the rails at that point. Okay, we're going to sit down and talk to our kid, our daughter, our son. First thing you need to do, again, deal with your own feelings first. Get yourself under control. Are you scared? Are you feeling guilty that you haven't had this conversation earlier? Do you feel perhaps like their falling into porn is going to negatively influence and impact your image problem? Like if my kid's in porno, then that's going to have an effect on me. We got to leave all of those issues at the foot of the cross before we ever bring those into the conversation with the kid. Avoid reenacting the Inquisition. Remember the Inquisition? Where they would try and, you know, pull out the pincers and put them on these torture racks. And have you been in porn? No, Dad. Are you sure? You know, putting fire to their feet. Look, if you could even get a forced confession out of your kid, let's just say that worked, which it won't. If you even could, what use would it be? How would that even help anything? We don't want to drill them. We don't want this to feel like an interrogation session. Instead, what we want to do is prepare our talk. We're going to think about this. How am I going to bring this up? We don't want to be watching the sports game, hit mute, and turn to our daughter and say, hey, how's porn going lately, honey? Take your time. Think through. What's my approach going to be? What am I going to say? Where are we going to have this talk? What setting? Could I bribe them to hang out with me? Maybe I could buy them dinner at their favorite restaurant, go see a movie, and maybe that's when we're going to talk about this. Choose wisely which parent should take the lead. I would tend to think that the husband would talk to the son and the wife would talk to the daughter. I've also heard that the father is having better inroads with the daughter, where she'll open up to him and not open up to her. So, what that means is you might be the more burdened parent. Maybe you've read about this more. Maybe you want to have the conversation with her, and yet you start to pray about it and you realize, you know, I think my husband would have a better shot, quite frankly. So we got to choose who we're going to send in. Moreover, we're going to start with asking indirect questions. Jonathan McKee is a youth pastor. He says teenagers have a PhD in one-word answers if we don't ask the right questions. How was school? He tells the story asking his daughter, how was school? Good. How was class? Good. And finally, after about, you know, 5 weeks of that, his daughter just said, Dad, stop asking me how school was. School always sucks. And so he asked her a different kind of question and got her talking about it. Moses says we got to repeat these principles. This shouldn't just be a singular talk. This is, you talk about it morning, noon, and night. Sometimes it's just bank shots. It's watching the television. You see something on there that's explicit and you make a comment, opens up a conversation. Here's a few ideas. Some of these might work. Some of these you might feel like are totally inappropriate for your kid. I'm just hoping to get the proverbial juices flowing. I read recently that this medical doctor was said that pornography use was connected with less enjoyment of regular sex. Why do you think that would be the case? McKee says use controversy. Get your kid to think, not just yes or no. Why do you think porn use would affect even like fornication? Why do you think that would be the case? Get them talking. Here's a good question. A lot of people define pornography differently. How do you think you would define it? You know why that's such an important question? Because your kid and you most likely have two different definitions of the word porn. And so you might ask your son, have you been looking at porn lately? And he thinks, oh, hardcore videos? No, but he's been looking at Playboy.com and pictures. How about this statistic? Breast implant surgery tripled from 2002 to 2003. Other surgery only increased 12%. And then you could ask, you know, something like this. Why do you think there'd be such an increase like that in our culture? What kind of things have you seen in the teens at school? Have you seen anything that would explain that? Why young women would be beefing up their bodies with plastic surgery? Or I read recently that married people have more pleasurable and more frequent sex than single people do. Why do you think that would be the case? It's pushing it. They might be a little bit creeped out to talk about this. They're probably thinking to themselves, I don't want to ask, why do you think it would be the case? Well, let me tell you about that, son. Have you heard that scientists are now comparing porn addiction to drug addiction? I was watching this YouTube video on this, and you know, you could show them the video, and I'd be like, "You think that's a fair comparison, porn?" Anyhow, this is going to get conversations going when you're watching the television show, when you're watching the movie, when you're watching any kind of reality TV, which is, in my opinion, just total cinematic garbage. If you're watching that kind of stuff and your daughter likes Next Top Model, sit there and give a critique of it. What do you think about that? Boy, I hate this just casual infidelity. You know, I hate, and just give your 2 cents. You know, there's 2 different ways to protect your kids. You might think of, how would I protect my kid from drowning? One way to protect them would be to keep them from water their whole life. The other way would be to teach them to swim. And that's the approach we want to take. There's lots of smut. There's lots of filth out there. We don't want to totally guard them to the point where they never see it. But as they slowly get introduced to this, we want to have a running critique of it. Eventually, we're going to have to ask direct questions such as, what do you think of these? Have you bumped into anything that's been stumbling to you lately on the internet? Not, have you seen porno? They're probably going to clam right up. Have you seen anything that's been like stumbling? Or do any of your friends struggle with porn? Or have any of your friends ever talked to you about porn or showed you porn? Typically, kids are a little bit more likely to open up about their friends' crap than their crap, okay? Let me say this, though. If your kid answers no to all 3 of those questions, that's telling in and of itself. Oh, so like, yeah, like 80% of kids are watching this all the time. Man, you and your friends must be like the second coming. Wow, you guys are really saintly. You should sign my Bible sometime, you know? Think about it like this. They're not talking. Keep at it. Be patient. Talk about the effects that you've seen. I've experienced this. I've been working with college students, or I've seen this in my friends' lives. You know, emphasizing with your kid, if you came into contact with this, honey, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world, right? If you were ever inappropriately touched, if you were ever taken advantage of, we'd be able to help you with that. It wouldn't be the end of the world. We just want to do what we can to be here with you through this process. You know, the safest place, sweetie, is to come and talk to mom and dad. If you ever came into contact with this, we want to talk. We want to hear about it first. That would be the biggest issue in our minds, is if we have a conversation about this. Then finally, the role of youth workers. You know, we don't want to view this as an either or black and white thinking. We want to use the youth worker as the ally, not the enemy, to this topic. So we don't want to foist all of these conversations off upon the youth worker. We also don't want to be having all these conversations ourselves. The truth is, the youth worker is probably more likely to hear about this than you. If only the parent would believe the youth worker when they hear it. You know, there's something that happens when it's your kid. It's difficult to believe that your kid is a sinner. You've been with them. You love them so much. You've invested in them. And then to hear, I think they got an issue. It's amazing. Parents with the most discernment are often blindsided by this, and they're the last ones to realize that there's a problem here. So the approach we want to take is don't just think, well, my daughter is being mentored by a youth worker, and so they're going to talk about that. We don't need to. No, you need to talk about this too. At the same time, how about talking with the youth worker, getting a good conversation going, so on and so forth. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking to yourself, is there any way we could talk about masturbation with about 500 people in the room? Yes, we sure can. We can talk about masturbation. Why not? Biblical ethics of masturbation. For one, masturbation is never explicitly mentioned in the Bible. John and Paul Feinberg, some of the most conservative Christian ethicists out there, they make this point. Mark Regnerus out of Texas, very conservative Christian. It's not in the Bible. Masturbation is not mentioned. Some people point to Ecclesiastes 9 where it says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. But that really has nothing to do. I don't even know why we would read that in this context. That's so inappropriate. Okay. The fact that masturbation is never mentioned is what we would call not just an omission, but a conspicuous omission. We would expect to read something on it. The Bible mentions fornication, adultery, homosexuality, incest, pedophilia, pederasty, lust, rape, bestiality. I mean, this covers everything from the very serious to the very banal and commonplace. And masturbation is one of the most pervasive issues in sexuality today. And the Bible doesn't say a word about it. And so I know some people will take a pretty hard line on masturbation. We don't. People say, well, masturbation is really connected with lust. True. You know, I mean, it's nearly impossible to masturbate without lusting. I suppose you could think about a lawnmower or something when you do it. But then you'd probably have worse issues on your hands at that point. At the same time, one can lust without masturbating. So if lust is really the issue, are we going to start to have confession circles about our lustful thoughts this week? Does that sound like a good idea for a house full of 20-somethings Christian singles? We're going to talk about every lustful thought. I hope you got 18 hours for that meeting because it's going long. Okay, this is the issue. Masturbation brings unnecessary guilt to singles. It does. As you think through this topic, you know, singles in most fundamentalist churches feel perpetually guilty over masturbation. You ask a fundamentalist Christian, how was your week? Well, it was bad. I masturbated twice this week. Okay, wait a minute. You're focusing your whole spirituality over an issue that the Bible doesn't even mention. Maybe you could make an arguable case that it's sinful, but it's not even worthy of being mentioned in the Bible. It's funny, you know, fundamentalist Christians never feel upset about the fact that they don't witness, that they're materialist, that they don't love, that they're judgmental, and yet masturbation is all they can think about. That's a huge, huge mistake. Misplaced guilt feelings over masturbation probably cause more serious spiritual harm in the lives of many singles than the act of masturbation ever could. The fact that you'd have all these singles walking around feeling guilty over this issue, I hate to put figures to this, but this is what I would say. I would rather see a young single person masturbate 100 or 1,000 times for every single time they fall into porn. Okay? This is a prioritized ethic, doesn't even compare between the two. You might be surprised, Dr. James Dobson, talk about a conservative Christian, focus on the family, former president. He says, it's my opinion that masturbation is not much of an issue with God. It's a normal part of adolescence, which involves no one else. It does not cause disease. It does not produce babies. And Jesus did not mention it in the Bible. I'm not telling you to masturbate. Thanks, James. And hope you will not feel the need for it. I think I would agree with him there, yeah. But if you do, it's my opinion that you should not struggle with guilt over it. Why do I tell you this? Because I deal with so many Christian young people who are torn apart with guilt over masturbation. They want to stop, they just can't. I would like to help you avoid that agony. Richard Foster, he says the same thing. Okay. So, it should be treated more seriously in excessive amounts. I've taught this to singles. They're like, how much is excessive? I'm like, I don't know. Wrong question, you know. One guy was plagued with guilt. And he said, I masturbated 4 times last night. I was just like, chill out on that. I'm going to start to bleed or something at that point. More serious for marrieds than for singles. I think married partners, this is a different ballpark. Because Paul says your body is not your own. Also affects sex drive. So that's something to consider. But we're talking about your kid, your 16-year-old son. What do you do if you catch him? Well, I'll leave it there. Okay. Let's finish up with securing your devices. For one, accountability software is not antithetical to grace-based spiritual growth. I know some people say, well, if you use technology to secure your device or your computer, well, that's like not grace-based. Okay, this isn't going to fix the problem. If you're a legalist and you get accountability software, you're still going to be a legalist, right? But it will help the believer. It's a tool. If you're under grace and you're trying to get help and you're using accountability software, you can use it under grace. Moreover, it's not either or. It's both and. It's not either I get my heart issues fixed or I look at pornography. It's how about we try and get the heart issues fixed even as we're being transparent and vulnerable? I think for somebody struggling with porn, I think this is an absolute must. This is so serious to get accountability. What do you really think is going to change if you keep going the way you're going? You know, this really has a realistic view of our sin nature. Paul, he says, I don't put any confidence in the flesh. And in that context of Philippians 3, he's the one saying, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews. You want to talk about moral living? It's me. And he says, even he doesn't put confidence in the flesh. He says, nothing good dwells in me that is in my flesh. So I think it's just being downright realistic with yourself. Now, I know some people could come back and be like, well, so blocking software, accountability software, you know, you're not really dealing with the issue of lust, okay? You're running from it. And to that, I would answer, yes, I am. Guilty as charged. In fact, that's what the Bible teaches on this. It tells us to flee sexual immorality. Flee, fugete, means to seek safety in flight, to become safe from danger by eluding it or avoiding it, to keep from doing something by avoiding it because of its potential danger. Paul says, make no provision for the flesh. Jesus prayed, do not lead us into temptation. So, I think this is a complete must for kids. Okay, a plan for kids. For one, keep devices in the common space of the house. These are principles. These aren't absolutes, but I'm going to give you what I think. And if you want to hear a different perspective, go listen to another porn seminar. But you're in my porn seminar, so I'm going to tell you what I think. So deal with it, okay? Keep devices in the living room. For one, you get to check how much tech time they have. You know, how much are they looking at the screen? Why is it that most American families, you know, when they go out to dinner, everyone's in front of the screen? That's been taught at home. We want to prevent that. We want to lessen it. Give them some time where they can earn it. But we're limiting it. Set strong boundaries early. It's going to be really difficult if they're already hooked on their screen and all of a sudden you come in and you say, oh, yeah, you can't use that anymore. You could have a revolt on your hands at that point. That's going to be difficult to lead through. Start with blocking. I think you should just block, you know, for a little kid, 5, 6 years old, just block everything except for Nickelodeon.com, YouTube Kids. Just give them only a couple sites they can look at. Just lock it down. Lock down the device. As they get older, that's not going to work. And so you actually want to shift from taking a posture where you're just trying to block them to where you're actually trying to keep them accountable, where they can see the issues that come up. When I get into this, I have to go and talk to Dad about it. Focus on what is truly dangerous. You know, parents who, and again, I'm going to give you my thoughts on this, and you can feel free to disagree. Parents who are all up in arms about the music their kids listen to, R-rated movies, violence. Okay, in a perfect world, maybe your kids wouldn't watch that. The problem is we're not in a perfect world, and we need to choose which issues we think are important. If you lock everything down, if you protect them absolutely, your kid is going to be Amish, he's going to rebel, he's going to hate it, and his friends are going to think he's weird. And so if you can show more levity and more leniency, let's say in watching a new action movie with violence, but be really strict when it comes to porn, you're going to buy back some credibility with your kid. I would say a really good case could be made for no data on cell phones for children. You know, it doesn't mean you don't get texts. It doesn't mean you don't get phone calls, voicemail, that sort of thing. But data is where you can connect to the internet on your phone. This would be something you really should consider. Does my kid even need that? Why does he need it? Okay. Fatalism says this. It says you can't 100% protect your family from porn. You know, that's a fatalistic attitude. But let me think about that with you for a second. Okay, you got $200,000. You're like, I'm going to put it in that bank vault. Yeah, it looks like a pretty good vault. And somebody says to you, don't you realize that criminals can break into those bank vaults? I've seen movies, man. They can get in there. They're going to steal your cash. There's no way to 100% protect that cash. And so you're like, okay, so where do you keep your money? And he's like, under my mattress? You know, you can't 100%, nothing is 100% certain in life. But can you take measures? Can you be responsible? I heard this illustration recently. You go over to your buddy's house and he says, hey, you know, check out my teenage son. We just remodeled his bedroom. You come in, he's looking at the paint and looking at the bed and the carpet and the ceiling and everything else. And you look over and in the corner you see he built a wet bar. You're like, how old is your son again? 15. You're looking through. You're like, Jack Daniels? And you just leave this in his room? And he's like, yeah. Wasn't your son the one who was caught drinking recently? Yeah. So you just leave the wet bar in here when your son struggles with drinking. Yeah. Okay. If somebody did that, no one would do something like that, right? That's so absurd. In fact, if somebody did that, you'd say, that is pretty poor parenting. For you to put something in your son's face and say, okay, you're not allowed to smell this, you're not allowed to look at it, but we're going to leave it right here with full access. Any time of day, you can access this, but don't touch it. Don't look and don't touch. That's pretty poor parenting. I would say that that was a mistake and a failure on the parent's behalf. The same thing is true with porn. Kids have full access to it in homes. Do something that shows that you're trying to stop this serious problem. I've got about 15 minutes left. You guys with me? Okay, I'm going over. No nasty emails this week. Well, you went over by 15 minutes. Okay, here's what I would like to suggest. I'm not going to give you 10 different options. I'm going to give you one for blocking, and I'm going to give you one for accountability. Now, you might say, well, I like covenant eyes more, or I like canine more, or I like good. Go and be with Christ. Do your thing, okay? If you have a plan, if you've studied it, if you like it, I am all for it. Wonderful. What I want to do is not confuse the daylights out of people that don't know any of this stuff. Okay, so I'm just going to give you one option and explain it. What's come to my attention is this thing called OpenDNS Umbrella. It's $20 a year. And instead of purely working through the router, which is the place through which you get the internet, right? This works through the cloud. What this means is you can lock down devices in your home as far as blocking is concerned, even if it's connected to a different router, a different Wi-Fi, or even if your kid's phone is on data. So you can get this installed, and what's cool about this, and I'm just going to kind of walk you through here. Did everyone catch that so far? OpenDNS, Umbrella, first link. Go down here. You're going to scroll down to the bottom of the screen. You want this option, 1 to 5 users. It's not for a business. It's for a home, right? Buy now, put in your information, 1 user. Maybe you move it up to 2. That's still only $40 a year. It's nothing. Put in your information. You're going to click through all of this different stuff. Okay, then you put in the information, pretty intuitive. Then you're going to go down to dashboard. That's how you control OpenDNS Umbrella on your router. So you click there. Go to configuration, which is up in the corner. And then you go to policy settings off to the left. You guys tracking? I'm going to have all of these screenshots, all of these instructions in an article. Everything I got up here, you'll just be able to scan right through. But this is the first time through. We're moving quick. Cool? Policy settings. So here, look at that. Okay, so you can go through and click academic fraud, adult themes, adware, lingerie, porn, nudity, adult content of any kind. You could pick the things you don't want your kid to see. Okay, you get to the bottom. Looks like I just did this for my house, so I did nudity, pornography, not podcasts. I almost clicked politics. I decided not to. Then you just click save. Make sure you save it. Okay, adding devices. So you add a mobile device. You click add new device. Pretty simple. You put in an email address. So your kid puts his email address in. And I don't have my phone, but not a big deal. Your kid would get the email, open it up, and install this software, which is in the cloud, onto his phone. So that would lock down his phone. Then you would lock down the desktop, and you'd lock down the laptop, and you'd lock down maybe your own phone. And that's going to follow. Now, one of the things a guy I know who's working on this, he said, I've only had 1 or 2 false positives. I think one of them, he said, I was trying to look up a UFC fight, and it blocked me. Because that just seemed like kind of in between whatever he had programmed. Then that's real intuitive. The kid gets the phone, you walk through it with it, install it, and it's password protected. Now what you could do is maybe the kid is a little genius and he gets out of it and deinstalls OpenDNS Umbrella on his phone. That's going to show up on your report. You're going to see little Johnny's phone disconnected at 11:45 last night. And so you can talk to him about that. There's reports on there. It'll also show those reports off to the right. It'll show what websites were blocked in which phone and which laptop. So you can say it wasn't Dad, it was Junior. Okay, then click download. You guys with me? Run it. That's pretty intuitive. okay, here's something interesting. Here's Circle Disney router. $100. This will set bedtimes for internet for certain devices. It does blocking. That's not something to keep an eye on if you want to get a good router. I'm just trying to get really practical here. Second, more importantly, blocking isn't good enough. If you want to get at porn, blocking for a porn addict just gets them excited because it becomes a game of how many times they can try and get around the blocker. Now, hopefully in the meantime, you're going to get the report that says he tried to access Playboy.com, and that's going to open up a conversation. But blocking might be necessary, but it isn't sufficient. Accountability is where it's at. Now, tons of tutorials on this on YouTube. I'm going to send them out. Really easy. I personally like Accountable to You. It's half the price of Covenant Eyes. It's cheaper, and it does a really good job. It even gives monitors text messages. So if there's something questionable, you would get a text. My buddy was chewing tobacco at home church, and he was spitting into his cup, and one of the women in the home church looked over at him and sent him this text message that said, hey, instead of spitting that, why don't you just swallow it, right? Well, 2 minutes later, his wife got a text message that said, why is this woman saying you should spit and swallow? That's how sensitive it is. It'll even pick up on nuance. So it'd be good for your kid. You got a teenage kid. It wouldn't monitor their texts, but it would only monitor something that would be questionable. So accountability software, here's the final step. This accountability software doesn't work well on Apple devices, iOS devices. And this is confusing, okay? With other devices, they run all of their apps through a singular browser. So it's kind of like the bottleneck. If you can monitor the browser, it's going to monitor it in this app or this app or this app. With iOS devices, the iPhone or the tablet or whatever, they have separate browsers for individual apps. So you could be on your Facebook app, which has a separate browser. Now, I've heard Apple is going to move toward running all of the different constellation of apps through one called Safari. But for now, this isn't going to be helpful. So what we have to do here is actually install accountability software on the phone, and then you have to lock down a number of things on that phone if you want this to be any help at all. If not, you're throwing $5 out the window a month. It's worthless. So this is what you would do here. You'd open up your phone. You could even do this with me if you want. You go to settings. You go to general. Next, you go to restrictions. And once you click on this, this screen is going to pop up. It's password protected. You need to have a spouse, friend, or roommate put in the passcode for you. If you put in the passcode, then you can put the passcode in to get back out and look at porn, right? But make sure your spouse picks a passcode that they won't forget. I did that with a buddy. He said, can you be my accountability partner? Sure. Put in a passcode for me. And I just did something real quick. And then a couple months later, he said, what's the passcode? And I said, I don't know. Locked down his phone. It was a real pain. So, okay. Then enable restrictions. Click here. And then what you're going to do is go down here to Safari. You're going to lock that down, lock down that browser so you can't access Safari. And you're also going to lock down installing apps. So you can't get a browser through Safari. You can't get a browser through installing different apps. So where do you get a browser? Accountability to You gives you a browser which it itself can monitor. Now, this is a little bit of a pain. If you're opening up an email and you're trying to open up the hyperlink, you have to copy the address and then open it up in Accountability to You's browser. Siri, it wouldn't disable Siri. But what it would do is it would stop you from searching stuff. So I could pull out my phone, call my wife,
or look up how to get to Xenos Christian Fellowship. It'll help to some degree, but it's going to lock things down. I mean, in some sense, it's going to make your iPhone a technological brick, right? It's going to stop different functions. At the same time, it's still an iPhone. I mean, it's still pretty versatile, but it's going to lead to accountability for it. Now, if you're still feeling confused, we're going to send out papers on this, how to do it. We're also starting a new ministry. It's kind of an ad hoc ministry. Vince Mitchell is volunteering his time, and he's a wizard. He did my website for free. He's a computer wizard, and he just put up this website, securingyourhome.net, and we're going to put resources up there. If you still can't figure it out, you can contact Vince, and he'll come and help you with it for free. But he also told me to include the point, if there's anybody else out there who can do this, he needs help. So if you're a tech wizard and you want to, you know, help out with people locking down devices, you should contact Vince at that website there.